sitting at the table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Respect. Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. Protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
It's my mistake, and let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression.
Expression,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
leisure,
health,
education,
progress,
culture,
human rights,
Carta Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We are building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and with me today is Jill Arnott, Executive Director of the Women's Center at the University of Regina. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that isn't going away anytime soon, violence against women. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you for having me.
I think we've had you on before a while ago, and it's good to return to some of these topics because it's almost time for a report card, you know, how are things going and that type of thing. But before we do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Women's Center, sort of how it started and what its purpose at the university is.
The Women's Center started in the 70s and during a time when there was lots of social action happening around women's rights. And it's evolved to provide a variety of services. Now we do a lot of educational stuff. We host events. We bring in speakers. We partner with lots of other community organizations and organizations on campus. So, for example, this year we had Vandana Shiva, who is a super fantastic feminist biologist, quantum physicist, from India, come to talk about seed saving and sort of the state of emergency, if you will, that is our current state of affairs here on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We also had Jackson Katz, who is another super fantastic individual from the States who does a lot of work on masculinity. So he works with lots of sports teams, military, around deconstructing the current construction of masculinity and talks a lot about the problems inherent in that construction and how men, you know, also are disadvantaged by that construction and how men can play a role in changing that, right? So that's some of what we do. We also provide crisis counseling, safe space on campus for all students. We have an alternative library, a place to eat lunch. So it's a busy place.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved with it in the first place? What was your path?
You know, I actually spent zero time there as a student. When I was on campus for a really long time. But I also worked full-time when I was a student. So I went to university, went to class, and left immediately, right? I didn't spend any time on campus, really, outside of attending, you know, the odd event, like Naomi Klein or Avi Lewis or events of that nature. But I applied for a job when I saw that it was posted 1 year, and mm-hmm. so now I've been there for a long time, 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and also teaching women's and gender studies, so I'm fortunate to have access to lots of cool stuff that goes on out there.
Right, right. And, of course, violence against women, that would be just one sort of small aspect that you would be concerned with, but it's really kind of an important thing because it's everywhere.
It is everywhere, and actually, we focus on it a lot during the 16 Days of Activism, which started on Tuesday on November 25th. That's mm-hmm. the beginning of the International Campaign Against Gender Violence, and it's the International Day Against Violence Against Women. So we did a kickoff. We hosted a dinner at Table 10, a fundraising dinner, mm-hmm. and we had a bake sale at the university that day. And so the proceeds that will be raised over the 16 days, the Women's Center will match, and then we'll send a donation off. Every year we do this, and this year the organization that we've chosen to support is the Malala Fund.
Oh, wonderful.
So focusing on empowering girls through education and mm-hmm. trying to change the world that way. But we also deal a lot with violence just in terms of women's everyday lives, right? Because we provide crisis counseling and resources on campus, we get calls from the community, and we have lots of students coming in to see us. We go out and give lots of talks on this subject. And so it's something we deal with actually all the time. It's sort of an ever-present issue.
Mm-hmm. So I guess just thinking about how you cope with it, how you deal with it. On the one hand, you're doing stuff that's preventative. And on the other hand, you're probably advising women what they can do to do things in ways that they don't put themselves at as much risk.
We spend a lot of time doing cleanup work, right? When people are leaving domestically violent relationships mm-hmm. or in the aftermath of a sexual assault, we do a lot of talking to the media about this particular issue. And one of the things that we get asked all the time is, what can we be teaching women to do so that they don't put themselves at risk? And my standard response is that it's time for us to stop focusing mm-hmm. on women putting themselves at risk and
right.
rather be teaching men and boys that it's not okay to assault or violate women in any way, whether that's physical or sexual.
Mm-hmm.
The women aren't up for public consumption, right? So the problem doesn't lie with those who are victimized, but rather with the perpetrators.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But at the same time, I guess everybody needs to know how to look after themselves and, whether you're a woman or a man, if you're wandering around downtown Regina at certain hours, maybe there's some places that you should avoid. There's places that I don't feel comfortable in, and I'm certain that you wouldn't want to be in either.
True enough. But I think, again, it's what you said, which is less about being female and more about just, you know, making sure that you're in well-lit spaces if you can, that you don't travel on your own mm-hmm. after dark. I mean, that's just sort of standard. Most, unfortunately, for most women, they will mm-hmm. know their attacker. And for most women, it will be, either a friend or a previous or a current partner or a family member.
Mm.
So for most women, this is not, violence doesn't come from the stranger, right?
Right.
And that's a story that we're often told, unfortunately, for most of us. It's going to be the case that it's somebody that we know. And so how do you teach women to be careful of the people that they know,
mm-hmm.
right? Because
mm-hmm.
again, that's not, we shouldn't be having to tell women you can't trust anyone.
True. Yeah,
no one, not
absolutely.
Your partner, not your
yeah.
dad, not your brother, not your friends. You can actually just trust no one because you're female, right? So we try really hard to focus on doing lots of good work if we can with young men. I certainly teach about this stuff in my classes, and it's about looking at the world in a different way, right? Because this idea that women are available and are up for public consumption is part of the culture that we live in. Mm-hmm. And so it's about encouraging young men to look at the world in a way that they haven't looked at it before.
Is there sort of an organized program in effect now that that basically touches on this? Like, I'm thinking of obviously anything that you're going to do, you want to start as early as possible.
Yep, and I don't know that there's anything that's sort of standard and mandatory that, you know, most young men would be exposed to. That certainly would be excellent if there was.
Mm-hmm.
We teach little kids, you know, not to touch other people, right? That you have to have boundaries and this and that. But what we don't do is ask them to question the world that they're living in and the messages that they're getting. And so when we are saying even simple things like you run like a girl,
mm-hmm.
you throw like a girl, when being a girl is somehow problematic when that's used as a way to sort of denigrate somebody else who is not female, you're making that the other. And that's the number one step in making violence okay, right, is to target an other. And another is somehow less than. And once something is less than, then it's okay. It starts to become okay to do violence. And so we have a cultural conversation where that's the norm. And so interrupting that is the key, I think, to making some serious change.
Right. And I wonder sometimes that the culture just staying on this particular aspect. I'm thinking back to many years ago now when Pamela George was killed. And you had basically... a couple of students who took her out and killed her. And how it's so hard to get your head around how that's possible, how they thought that it was acceptable or okay to do that.
That's a particularly difficult case, in part because the boys in question had been friends of mine in high school, and so it was shocking to my friend group,
right.
in lots of ways, maybe not so much. What I think is most shocking about that case, though, is that the judge told the jury to remember that she was a prostitute before they left to go and deliberate. Because, again, she was made other. And so somehow the fact that she was a sex trade worker erased her humanity. And that's often the case with victims, right? We saw it with the victims of Robert Picton. We see it often with our Aboriginal or Indigenous stolen sisters, that these other sort of details about what they might have been doing, whether they struggled with an addiction, overshadow the fact that they were human beings who had a right to live. And somehow, because there are these other details we can talk about, it's less traumatizing, it's less important, they were of less value. But any one of us could be, you know, sort of... we could have our lives dug through, and certain details could be focused on to make us less than as well. It's just that there are certain markers with certain people. And again, that's part of, unfortunately, in Canada, our cultural conversation around Indigenous peoples, right? So women, Indigenous women in particular, we see it in the States with the Ferguson case, right? This stuff is fairly common. Rehtiah Parsons was, you know, a young woman in down east who was sexually assaulted and at a party had been drinking, was throwing up at the time of the sexual assault. It was photographed, right, put on, sent out all over everywhere. She would eventually commit suicide because her life was ruined. She couldn't take it. And again, we have young people who think that it's okay. Nobody was concerned, right? And even in the initial investigation, found that there wasn't really anything to pursue. She was throwing up while she was being sexually assaulted. She was unable, clearly, to give consent. That should have been a problem right off the bat. But we are so used to this idea that it's just that this kind of behavior is harmless. Right? This is kids being kids. It's boys being boys. It's not boys being boys. It's a violation of a human being. And that's how we need to look at these things.
And I don't know, I'm just thinking here, maybe this should be part of a broader program to educate people and make them aware, like in terms of First Nations people, up until the recent past, the average person really wouldn't know the story of why First Nations people are in the situation they're in now. Like, why did this happen? And now, so just recently now, people my age are starting to find out about residential schools, where if you'd asked me what a residential school was when I was going to school, I would have no idea.
Absolutely, because it's not part of the history that's taught.
Yeah.
Right? That's not part of the formal history of Canada, because it's not the kind of story that most Canadians want to acknowledge or tell, because it's not something they can feel proud of. We talk a lot about white privilege at the university, and it's come up a lot on Facebook over the last few days with this Ferguson business. And a lot of people are outraged, right, that anybody wants to call into question a system that might be disadvantaging certain groups of people. And most of the people who are outraged are white, right? And it's an interesting phenomenon. It's the same thing when you're talking about gender violence. Most of the people who get really upset and really defensive are men. Now, this is not to say that individual men are bad people or are problematic. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting, though, is that most of the violence that's perpetrated against both other men, children, and women are men, right? Men are the perpetrators in most cases. And so to be so defensive, nobody's saying it's you specifically. We do have a problem with masculinity. We do need to talk about it if we want it to be different. Most men have women in their lives that they care about, and so should be invested in changing this conversation.
Right, right. And I think too, staying with masculine, you have these team sports, notably hockey, and they have a culture all their own.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, I don't know, I don't have that much contact with people that are involved, but it's something that perhaps coaches should be made aware of, you know, and perhaps they are now. It makes you wonder, though, you know, going back to the time of Pamela George, what sort of attitudes would you find in a locker room at that time?
I think in lots of ways, not that different than now.
Yeah.
The NFL has had to come out and make a major statement because of the incident with Ray Rice and his wife in the elevator. But prior to that, they hadn't really either.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there have been some very public incidents by some very public figures which have forced some of these sort of elite clubs where masculinity is taken to the next level. It's hyper-masculinity, right? So that they've been forced to kind of acknowledge that there is a problem,
mm-hmm.
right? Maybe within their culture, but also with masculinity at large, right? And where some really, you know, prominent figures have come forward and said, this is actually not okay, right? We don't support this kind of behavior, never mind just the heads of these organizations, but individual players as well who've said,
mm-hmm.
this isn't okay, and who are willing to challenge some of the stereotypes that people are expected to adhere to, right? We've got some homosexual players, gay players coming forward and saying, like, this is who I am and that's okay,
mm-hmm.
who are challenging these ideas that there's only one way to be a man. And that's really key because these are some of the people that are held up as the ideal. And so when we start to have people with power and influence like that challenging these dominant ideas, it gives little kids access to a different way of thinking. And that's important.
I don't know whether it's just my Canadian bias, but we seem to see more of that down in the States. And it seems to me, say, just looking at our own situation here with the Rough Riders, let's say, when they have the odd, every so often you'll have a player get into problems with authorities. And generally speaking, you get the sense that the club management is not going to have that happen. They're going to deal with problems, and if their players can't measure up to reasonable community standards, they're gone.
Yes
or
and no.
Would you disagree?
The Riders have been on a bad, bad streak for
They've
a
had
while.
Their problems.
It was
yeah.
problem after problem after problem mm-hmm. after problem. I think it's the mm-hmm. culture, and I think that when I say the culture, I'm talking about sort of the North American,
mm-hmm.
right, Hollywood, pop culture, where these messages are played out again and again and again, many of which we take in, you know, completely unconsciously,
mm-hmm.
magazine ads, TV ads, right? And this is right down to that it's the woman who's driving the Swiffer, right? Who's at home with the kids, whose body parts are being chopped up to create this perfect woman. I mean, this stuff, it all contributes to this idea that women are objects,
mm-hmm.
that women are not equal. And so when we live in a culture where that is the dominant messaging, we're going to have problems. I think, you know, it's easier to look at the States simply because it seems like the mm-hmm. ante is upped on just about everything, right? In terms of guns, in terms of just even volume, right? In terms of inner city or ghetto, hood, whatever you want to call it, right? I mean, we tend to see more of that highlighted than we do in Canada. It doesn't mean it's not there. I just think it's highlighted more and it's glamorized in terms of what we see in the States because of music video, because of movies,
mm-hmm.
right? So the associations are different. We have these problems here, no doubt. There was a Canadian hockey player who was just accused of harassing a porn star that he had dated and was bothering her relentlessly. I think it crosses the border for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We have a terrible history, as you acknowledged, right, with colonialism. Lots of Canadians are wondering about this business in the States with Ferguson. We have our own problematic mm-hmm. history where racism is concerned, and it's the same with sexism, right? The Pamela George case is a great example. But and universities have, you know, even though there's not necessarily any frats to be pledging, mm-hmm. you know, not in the same way that there is in the States, there's hazing rituals. There certainly is a culture around, you know, first-year students
mm-hmm.
and being looked at as fresh meat and some chants that are fairly unsavory. And, you know, it's not that different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do hear from time to time of some situations on campuses and I guess everywhere. no campus is immune of women especially being taken advantage of in one situation or another, and not necessarily by students.
Not necessarily by students, and often the administration is complicit.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, U Virginia's in huge trouble right now. All frat activity has been suspended. They've had a whole string of people come forward, tell their story. Rolling Stone just published an article last week on gang rape at one of the frat houses, and the administration was made aware. They're now being investigated, right? Obama is enforcing all kinds of policies around Title IX so that women have a comfortable environment in which to access education. And what's concerning is it's concerning that the administration would have known that there was a potential risk to other women because they'd had several complaints and chose to do nothing about it because they didn't want to be known as the rape school. But what's more concerning is that there have been studies done where young men admit to sexual assault and multiple sexual assaults. They just haven't gone caught.
Again, it goes back to culture.
Yeah. What's happening there with the disconnect, right? That you feel like that's okay to violate another human being in that way. This is, I think, what we need to be looking at, right? The lack of a sense of community, the lack of empathy, the lack of connection, you know, to another person's humanity, no matter who that person might be, right? That you can do something to them because they are simply an object for you to use however you choose.
It just occurs to me there are some video games out there that are really kind of horrendous that you look at them and you think, you know, I don't think I want anybody to play these games, let alone somebody under 18 or under 15 or whatever.
Absolutely. Grand Theft Auto is one of them. And I'm like kind of old school. I don't know much about video games anymore because we don't have them in my house. I don't, you know, that's not my thing. But they're not super female friendly. That's for sure. And I think a lot of what we see in music video, in video games, in our movies, in our popular culture, desensitizes us to violence in general, right? So that when we see those things, it's not horrifying. It should be, but it isn't.
Yeah.
And once again, when somebody becomes othered, when something becomes normal, it's just no big deal. It's off the radar, right? It's sort of, it's just, you just keep flipping the channel, right?
I'm pretty sure it's one of the ways that the U.S. military sort of conditions their soldiers to kill people.
And there's been some serious problems within that institution as well, right, around rape culture and the way women have been treated, right? This seems to be across the board.
Yeah, it makes you wonder that there are ways of approaching different problems or objects that you want to achieve. It would be nice if somebody would come up with a program to achieve the goal of, equality for women. It sounds, even saying those words, it just sounds so strange that here we are in 2014 that we're even discussing it.
Absolutely. I just actually was reading some commentary regarding the Gomeshi fiasco. I'm not really sure what to call it. And women women are part of this problem as well, right? Commenting and saying, I just don't buy it. All these women coming forward now. Why are they coming forward now? Like, they can't all have had the same experiences. We live in a culture that's not friendly towards victims of sexual assault. That's how come there. One woman was brave enough, and that gave permission to other women to say me too.
Right.
It doesn't mean it didn't happen, but we're very skeptical, right? We are still living in a world where we're reluctant to believe, even though we see it all the time and we know that it happens. We are reluctant to believe, and you know, we often point the fingers at the states. Canadians had a really hard time acknowledging that their beloved Jean Gomeshi could have engaged in such unsavory behavior and criminal behavior.
Right, right. And, you know, even the behavior that perhaps was not criminal, but still, I think for the average person, shocking, you know. There are things that people do that, I guess for want of a better term, let's say thrill-seeking. And it's a lifestyle that kind of leads you sort of down the garden path. You know, one thing doesn't satisfy anymore, so now you go on to the next exciting thing, and that doesn't satisfy you anymore, so then you go down to the next thing. And where do you cross that line?
I think for most people who are engaged in sort of alternative forms of sexuality where there is an element of pain or violation, or it's consensual, and they've been very quick to to make that distinction, right? Anybody who engages in S&M, BDSM, mm-hmm. kink of any kind,
yeah.
have been very quick to say, like, that is not what we're about.
Right.
This yeah. is about consent. These are two people mm-hmm. who are willing to engage in this behavior.
Right.
Right? So not the same thing. And, you know, I don't know who gets to make the determination. I think when two people are willing to consent, when it's adults who are able to give that kind of informed consent, mm-hmm. when there are safe words and safeties built in, you yeah. can do whatever you like.
Sure.
That wasn't the case. These adults have been very clear that this was not welcome, nor was it invited. What I find interesting is that his mom has just kind of become part of the conversation, right? Mm-hmm. Because he was ordered to live with his mother when that right. was part of his bail condition, right? Condition of release was $100,000 bail and to live with his mom and to not leave the country. So she's all of a sudden entered the conversation. His dad just died. She's been left right. alone to deal with this. I mean, she's got to be in a terrible state. And there have been comments as well on social media about, like, well, you know, woman hating had to come from somewhere, like, you know, I wonder what his relationship with his mom was like. Mm-hmm. So no matter what we're talking about or how we choose to go at it, somebody always manages to bring the blame back around to the female. And, you know, mm-hmm. if there's a female in the equation anywhere, she's got to be the one to blame.
Yeah.
How about he just actually, as it turns out, has a super big ego, is a bit of a narcissist,
yeah.
and thought he should have access to whomever, whenever he chose, to do whatever he chose to do.
Yeah.
Maybe that's all this is about. Maybe it's not about anything else. Maybe it's just about some privilege.
Yeah. I'm going to take a moment here, and we're going to leave this topic completely before we go to the break, and then we're going to play some Tracy Chapman.
Nice.
But I just wanted to talk about our new CJTR app.
Oh, boy.
We have an app, which is great. You can put it on your phone, on your Android or on your iPhone, and you've got CJTR with you all the time.
Nice.
Which is great, and you can... check out our Twitter feeds and Facebook, things like that. And it's free. Let's see now. I've got a little thing here to read. And it's been developed by Push Interactions. And it features online streaming video, 24 hours a day with links to the website and all that good stuff. The app's free, available in the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. So... download it today. I have it on my phone. In fact, I was a tester.
Oh, nice.
Which was great, yeah. Alrighty. Well, we'll do the break here now, come back with Tracy Chapman, and continue our discussion with Jill Arnott from the Women's Center at the U of R.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds... Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds... People gonna rise up, get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare line, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. And finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution.
And that was Tracy Chapman talking about a revolution, one of my favorites. And you don't hear too much from her lately, unfortunately.
I haven't heard anything new either, but she sure is one of the oldie but a goodies.
Yeah, and she's a bit of an activist, too. I don't know if she's still on the activist trail as well, but every so often you'll see her on a stage in support of various things.
And I don't know too much about her lately, but she certainly lends her voice to lots of good stuff.
Wonderful voice, wonderful voice. Okay, let's talk about the 16 days of activism, which I think we're in the middle of now, are we not?
Yep, started on the 25th on Tuesday. So each day in the 16 days that follow the 25th mark a particular day, right? So at the university, because it's such a terrible time of the semester, because the semester's wrapping up, students are totally frazzled, we choose a few days to mark. And so, like I said, we did the kickoff on Tuesday. On Monday, December 1st, is World AIDS Day, so we'll be having a bake sale and handing out ribbons. On the 4th, we're actually having the vigil for December 6th, because the 4th is the last day of classes. Okay. 6th is a Saturday, and nobody will be at the university. So December 6th, though, is the Day of Remembrance for the Montreal Massacre.
Right.
December 10th, we're having a bake sale again. It's International Human Rights Day, right, which, of course, you know. And so we try to pick a few things to sort of highlight or mark. So the 4th is going to be the vigil for us this year. It's the 25th anniversary of the shooting at École Polytechnique by Marc Lépine, where he killed 14 female engineering students. Really a bit of an ugly and sort of horrifying moment in Canadian history. The Long Gun Registry was the government, Liberal government's attempt to respond to that. It came into play a couple of years later, and of course, as we know, Harper government scrapped it a few years ago. But the country was really sort of reeling after that. It was not common for there to be mass violence of that nature in Canada, and Canadians really weren't sure how to respond. And so the Long Gun Registry was sort of a tangible way to say that this kind of violence was not acceptable and not okay, and that we collectively, you know, wanted to do something about it. So every year there's a vigil held, sometimes multiple vigils. We hold one on campus each year, sometimes really well attended, sometimes not so much, depending on a number of things, including the weather, because of how we're in Saskatchewan. We think it's important to gather, though, because it was a really shocking event, not only because of the level of violence, but because it really was a really graphic picture of the problem that we have where gender is concerned, that we've sort of been talking about for the entire show, and that is that being female is a problem. Being female in the wrong place, in somewhere where you're not welcome, in somewhere where somebody doesn't feel that you have earned the right to be, can be problematic. And that's not different today, I don't think. Women are still experiencing violence of various kinds on a regular basis. And so it really is important to gather together in whatever community you can and take a few minutes and really think about what that means, right? And how we can participate in creating a culture within Canada where that is not the case, right? Where we know that women are at risk, and where we are actively working all of the time and collectively to change that.
While you're talking there, I took a few minutes to look at my computer because we talked about Marc Lépine, and one of the tragedies is we know his name.
Absolutely.
But we don't know the names, like, if anybody asked me who one of the victims was, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Wikipedia can tell us.
Yep.
So I'm just going to read them here.
Absolutely.
Geneviève Bergeron, who was a civil engineering student. Hélène Colgan, who was a mechanical engineering student. Nathalie Croutot, mechanical engineering student. Barbara Daigneault, mechanical engineering student. Anne-Marie Edward, chemical engineering student. Maud Havernick, materials engineering student. Maryse Lagagnère, budget clerk in the École Polytechnique Finance Department. Maryse Leclerc, materials engineering student. Anne-Marie Lemay, mechanical engineering student. Sonia Pelletier, mechanical engineering student, Michelle Richard, materials engineering student, Annie Saint-Arnaud, mechanical engineering student, Annie Turcotte, materials engineering student, and Barbara Klusnik, Wetchewitz, I'm sorry I murdered that name there, nursing student. So there are the names of the victims. And like I say, I just felt kind of obligated to mention them because their murderer comes to our lips so easily.
Absolutely.
And
that's one of the things we do at the vigil. We have their pictures and we have sort of a little bit about them, and it's available, you know, sort of on a table for people to come and have a look at so they can see who these victims were. It's important, I think, in this conversation around the Montreal Massacre to note that Marc Lépine grew up in a domestically violent home. Mm-hmm. And it's a part of the story that doesn't get told very often. I think makes us feel a little bit better to think that he didn't just grow up in a home that is like everybody else's, mm-hmm. right? It's much easier for us to understand what happened if we think that he's a monster that sort of sprang fully formed out of the darkness and into the light, and that he's some sort of shocking aberration. And while I wouldn't say that necessarily people who grew up in a domestically violent home are destined to, you know, repeat mm-hmm. his fate, certainly we know that violence begets violence, and that violence is cyclical, and that children that grow up in domestically violent homes are more likely to either be perpetrators or victims. And so to grow up in a home where his mother was not allowed to comfort him, the one other adult in the home that he should have been able to count on for protection and for mm-hmm. comfort when he cried was not allowed to provide that for him, makes me sad. I have a little boy of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine what that must have been like for him. And so we need to tell the whole story. And that's not to say that what he did was okay. That's certainly mm-hmm. not what I'm saying. But we do need to understand the context, right? Violence does beget violence. Mm-hmm. We do need to address the shocking levels of violence that are so common in our communities, because this is where they lead us. They don't lead anywhere good. And so when we start taking domestic violence seriously, when we start taking that programming seriously and insist that resources be made available, that people be held accountable, that programming be available to those who also are found to be offenders,
mm-hmm.
you know, then we'll be sending a strong message that actually we're invested in change, because that's where the change is going to come from.
Right. And it really involves identifying people at risk of offending.
Absolutely.
So we can do something about it before it happens.
Absolutely. It's about identifying some core beliefs that are really problematic. And if we can't get to them ahead of time, like I said, once they're in the system, mm-hmm. to be able to provide those resources and that programming that will allow somebody the opportunity to change.
Right.
Currently, we don't have that.
Yeah. One of the biggest disappointments, I think, that I have with our current federal government in particular, but the provincial government is not that far behind, is providing programming to inmates in our federal and provincial institutions so that they're equipped when they leave the institution, when they go out that door, that they are less of a risk to reoffend.
Absolutely.
Because currently the rate of reoffending on anything you want to mention, mm-hmm. the rate of reoffending is too high.
Recidivism is through the roof, and typically going to jail just means you're going to come out with a better criminal skill set.
Mm, exactly.
We have good people, no doubt, working in those systems who are desperate for things to be different and who are doing mm-hmm. what they can. But we need it to come from the top down. We need resources allocated. We need it to be mandated
mm-hmm.
and acknowledge that it's a necessary part of moving this country forward.
Yeah. And I think we all hear about programs that they're successful. They work. They're wonderful. And then you find out they've lost their funding.
All too common, unfortunately.
You know, I'm thinking, this is just basically off the top of my head here, but I know there's a program that deals with sex offenders,
mm-hmm.
and COSA, Responsibility, the brain is not working, but anyway, I think people know what I'm talking about. And their funding has just been sliced after achieving, I think, about an 80% rate of success, where previously it was way below 50%. In fact, for all intents and purposes, people who are in prison for sexual offenses, they're almost guaranteed to reoffend when they left. And this program was making a huge difference and our federal government cut their funding.
And unfortunately, that seems to be not the anomaly. We have a political climate that doesn't value anybody who falls outside the norm, anybody who is not sort of an elite, right? We've got a system that really is looking to maintain the status quo for those who have already made it, who are making lots of money, who have the white picket fence, who are far removed from any of these kinds of behaviors, although we have some allegations of sexual misconduct currently in play within our parties that are being investigated. And it's interesting to note that Justin Trudeau has been on the hot seat for having chosen to suspend two of his members while an investigation happens, on the hot seat, facing some stern criticism from both the Conservative Party and the NDP for having acted as swiftly as he did, for taking the kind of action that he did. And he said, but when there is a report of that nature, what choice do I have but to take action, like, immediately? Which is, of course, the right response. To be castigated for choosing to take some action when there are reports of sexual misconduct is so ridiculous that it's shocking that that's what we're actually talking about, but unfortunately reflects, I think, a dominant attitude in this culture that stuff's not to be taken seriously, even though the complainant, in at least one of the cases, came from the NDP party.
Yeah, right.
You know, her own party is saying, well, she didn't really want to get anybody in trouble, and this shouldn't have been done, you know, in such a public manner. You could have just told them to, you know, take a week off while we investigate. Downplaying. And Trudeau has just simply said, I absolutely stand behind what I did. I needed to take action, and I did. That's what I thought was appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it reflects a larger attitude, right? That this stuff is just not as serious as it actually is. That it's not, certainly not serious when the offenders come from that particular social group.
Right. I've remembered the name of that group that I mangled. It's Circles of Support and Accountability.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically what they do is provide support for people who are released. They've served their entire sentence, and now they have to be released into the community. And so they're assigned people who basically meet with them on a weekly basis and see how things are going. It's a very sort of a casual type of thing, but serious. And they're held accountable for their actions at that point, and they can actually be picked up again, you know, if they don't show up for their gatherings.
It functions like a probation's kind of,
it's almost, you know, it's almost like that.
Same sort of framework.
But it's there's more of a support aspect to it, you know. So it's a very valuable program that our government has chosen to stop supporting.
And I think that this is the thing, right? It's not that there are no answers. Right? And people are being creative and coming up with all kinds of attempts. There's just not enough investment in them. It's not like we just have to say, well, there it is. There's just always going to be violence. Too bad. Just nothing I can do. Hope for the best. Right? Which is kind of the attitude that we see. Trudeau chose not to take that attitude, and I think that that's an example that we all could kind of, no, you absolutely can take action. And you should. We should all feel that same obligation to take that kind of action until something gets sorted out, right? Whether that's some sort of punishment, whether that's programming that's put in place, in whatever context you might be talking about, that there's action that can be taken and that we should all feel the responsibility to participate.
Not to deviate too far from what we're talking about here, but I'm just wondering what your opinion of, or your understanding is of what our government calls victims' rights.
Can you be a little bit more specific?
That's the problem. I wonder. that's what they're predicating some of their changes to the criminal code on. And I don't understand it. How does worrying about the victims more? I don't know. To me, it's more political than anything. It sounds good in theory that, okay, now we're going to look after the victims. But how? You know, how is it going to make a difference in the long run, in the overview of say, for example, victims of violence?
Well, and unfortunately, I feel like a lot of what happens with this government is pandering. I'm very wary under this particular political rule of much that goes on. There's also changes to the universal child care benefit. But it's going to replace child tax. So it's actually not making anything better. They're just moving some money around and selling it in a different kind of package, right? That seems to be what this government is up to. It's what they're good at. I feel really wary, like I said, of sort of anything that this government does, particularly where prison and offender victim stuff is concerned, because they've had a big move towards privatizing prisons and having it be a moneymaker.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in my estimation, whatever they're up to is probably about furthering that agenda rather than reducing the number of people we have in jail. Now we're looking to increase incarceration, right?
Yeah.
So we can continue
to
make money because it's big business. So
yeah.
I'm uncomfortable generally with this kind of conversation from this particular party, this particular government, because they haven't displayed that they are invested in any real change. What they have displayed is that they're interested in big business and mm-hmm. more money, not in actually improving the conditions in our communities.
I go back to my initial statement of you hear these wonderful programs that are doing great work, and then all of a sudden, well, that was temporary funding, and it's gone.
Status of Women has lost funding. Native Women's Association of Canada has lost funding. That was like the first thing Harper did when he took power, what seems like 100 years ago, like so long ago that I scarcely remember what it was like not to live under Harper's rule. First things that he did. And so I don't know, it's hard for me to take him seriously when the very first message that he was intent on sending was that women kind of don't matter, particularly Indigenous women. We don't care. And it's been nothing but more of the same sort of ever since. He dresses it up a little bit more nicely. The presentation is maybe a little bit more cultivated and classy, but that is generally, you know, where things have been going. And he doesn't care about women. He doesn't care about Indigenous women in particular. Refuses to call the national inquiry, despite being chastised by everybody in the world for failing to do so. It's hard for me to believe that he's taking inmates' rights seriously, that he's taking victims' rights seriously. I don't care who he's talking about. I don't believe he's taking it seriously, and that he's invested in any kind of positive change for this country, you know, that would reflect what most Canadians hold to be very dear ideals and values about being Canadian and what it means to be Canadian.
Well, let's change the topic slightly.
Mm-hmm.
We know that government hasn't been too much help to us here lately. What can we do?
We can start by having the conversation, right? Lots of this stuff makes people really uncomfortable, makes people feel defensive. And so I guess I would suggest that having conversations in your home, in your communities, in your peer groups, in your families. What do we mean when we say, you know, that people need to man up, that grow up, you know, big boys don't cry? Let's investigate what some of these things look like. What are the expectations of being a man or a boy today? Right? What are the pressures that you feel? That's where we start to unpack what it means. That's where we start to unpack this messaging that is often so subtle and flying under the radar that gives boys this idea that unless they're somehow being violent, proving their masculinity often involves a show of violence and often against women. So we need to have a way in, right? And some of that starts at home. It starts with having conversations about this very thing, about the pop culture that they're exposed to. When I teach my class, we talk a lot about various and sundry forms of pop culture, and that it doesn't mean you can't like that rap song. It doesn't mean you can't enjoy who might be singing about something or rapping about something that's kind of unsavory. What it does mean is that you need to be critical about what you're listening to, right? Don't take it in blindly. Have those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he saying that? Is it possible that he's being a little tongue-in-cheek with that particular messaging, right? But, like, let's look at it honestly for what it is, and give the boys in this culture some freedom to define who they want to be outside of this sort of violent, hyper-masculine, having to prove anti-gay, anti-female sort of persona and mask that they're expected to put on, even if that's not who they are, right, in order not to be a target themselves of other men's violence.
Right, right.
Right, start opening that up for conversation, start challenging people when they say things that are offensive, when they're engaged in behavior that, you know, is violating and offensive and oppressive to other people. That's the place to start. We don't have something mandated, but we can all do that in our
mm-hmm.
lives.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think of how this could be accomplished. Should it be part of school curriculum in, what, health or something like that? I mean, some formal commitment to having this conversation you're talking about. It just seems necessary. I think on average, I don't know where I'm quite going with this, but if you've got a well functioning family, and one of my problems, not exactly a problem, but one of my disappointments is I never had a sister. And I think that if you're in a family with more than one sibling and you got sisters, if there's you know, brothers and sisters, that kind of relationship, I think that should go a long way. If you've got a good relationship with your sister, you should have good relationships with women generally. Am I being optimistic on that or unrealistic?
I think, you know, maybe perhaps you underestimate the influence of, you know, sort of everything else in a young man's life.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he wouldn't stand for, and I know this to be true based on my experience in various and sundry capacities in the community and work that I've done, that what somebody might not tolerate in terms of behavior toward their sister, they might have no problem doling out toward their partner. And so there is not necessarily a relationship there that can be relied upon. Right? What... because of these other pressures, right? Because of these other expectations, social expectations of what it means to be a man, and just sort of screwed up ideas, right? I don't talk about social expectations as though there's some sort of excuse. It's just that we, men are expected to be a certain kind of men. Men feel pressure not to get called a fag, right? Not to be called a pussy, not to be called, you know, to be called out for running like a girl, for throwing like a girl, for crying like a girl, anything associated with the feminine, right? And so in an effort to reject that and to prove that they're not that, because the messaging they're getting is that anything associated with the feminine is somehow less than, the ante is up on the masculine side of things. And so it means less access to a full range of emotions. It means less access to a variety of choices in terms of who you want to be, in terms of career, in terms of just identity. And so boys are not winning at all here. But there's such a huge, huge number of sources where they get this messaging from. And because it flies so under the radar so much of the time, I think we can't take for granted that family or siblings or good friends or, you know, will necessarily counteract all of that. Certainly those things help. Right, but when our entire culture is invested in messaging that suggests that women are somehow less than, that women have a particular place, when we still only pay women 70 to 80 cents for every dollar that a man makes, that's a cultural investment in keeping women down. And it's built right into our institutions, right? So we need to start having those conversations openly, calling it what it is, even though it makes us feel uncomfortable. We need to give boys permission to be who they are outside of this very narrow box that's been established for them.
I guess what I'm searching for here is the magic bullet or the silver bullet, you know, how do we solve this?
I don't know that there's one thing, right? I think it starts in all these pockets. I think it starts absolutely, though, with calling it what it is. You have to be able to name it, right? This is a secret shame that lots of boys carry, that they're not masculine enough. They're trying not to be a target, right?
All right. Yes.
And so starting there is a huge step. That's something we don't talk about all the time. We don't talk about masculinity as being problematic, ever. Right? How many conversations do you have about, I mean, I talk about it all the time. Most people don't talk about this ever, right? True. Every time they watch a movie, every time they see a music video, every time they hear a song on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? This is not something, but why not?
Yeah.
Right? When somebody's calling a woman a bitch, when somebody's, we need to call those things out and have the conversations with our kids. Like, why do you think that that's okay? Right? Do you think that's okay? What do you think of when somebody says that? When you hear that music, when you see that movie, when you see that, whoever it might be, how does that make you feel? Right? What do you think about that? So that they know that they can be critical in their engagement of this stuff. So that they have permission to look at it critically.
Well, on that note, we've run out of time. It's been great talking to you. And we'll have to do this again, because I was just thinking of more avenues to go down that we don't have time for. So thanks very much, Jill.
Thanks for having us.
Really appreciate you being here. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."
This is The Talent Pool on 91.3 FM, CJTR, a look at Regina's live music scene.
At Broadway's Lounge on Friday night, don't miss the Dan Silger Band. And on Saturday, the acoustic jam runs from 3:30 till 8 p.m. That's every Saturday at Broadway's Lounge, 1305 Broadway Avenue. At the Artful Dodger tonight, Rebecca Laskew with her CD release party. And then on Saturday, catch Spellbound performing live at the Artful Dodger, 1631 11th Avenue. At the Moose Jaw Cultural Center tonight and tomorrow, Central Collegian presents Guys and Dolls. And on Tuesday, December 2nd, Saskatchewan Express presents Silver Snow Follies, their 25th anniversary December show. That's at the Moose Jaw Cultural Center at 217 Main Street North. At Casino Regina Show Lounge on Tuesday the 2nd, CJTR proud to present an intimate evening with Frank Mills. Keep listening for your chance to win tickets. Wednesday the 3rd, it's The Trues, Casino Regina Show Lounge.
This has been The Talent Pool on 91.3 FM, CJTR, Regina Community Radio.
91.3 FM, CJTR, Regina Community Radio. Our programming is made possible by community-minded businesses like Mercedes-Benz of Regina and by listeners like you.
We're just going to pause here for a moment, and we've got a special song that we'd like to play for you. It's a song that's written by Bruce Crowe, and this is a happy birthday from his friend Mark Briggs, who is also playing on it. The name of the song is In That Case.
Everybody, welcome to the Putumayo World Music Hour, a journey around the globe through the music of many cultures. In San Francisco, I'm Rosalie Howarth, along with Dan Storper. And Dan, with Thanksgiving upon us, we're going to concentrate today on one of the major themes of the holiday.
We've cooked up a set of songs about food and drink that will make your mouth water. We're starting in the Dominican Republic with Juan Luis Guerra's Ojalá Que Llueva Café, I Hope It Rains Coffee. He sings, I hope there's a torrent of coffee, yuca, and tea from the sky, a block of white cheese, and a mountain of watercress and honey.